Welcome to Suit Yourself, the podcast of the Irish Surgical Training Group, the ISTG, hosted by Sinead Ramjet, Fintan Ryan, and me, Vinnie Riley.
Whether you're a medical student, a curious listener, or a seasoned surgeon, we hope to provide content that will help develop your knowledge, interest, and understanding of common surgical topics.
We would like to emphasize that the information presented in this podcast is for educational purposes only, and is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the ISTG Suit Yourself podcast. I am your host for today, Sinead Ramjet, and joining me today is a guest that needs no introduction. As a trailblazer in the realm of general and breast surgery, he holds the prestigious position of Professor and Chair of Surgery at RCSI Beaumont, while also serving as the head of the School of Medicine at RCSI University of Medicine and Health Sciences. Our distinguished guest started his journey in the medical world at University College Dublin, where he obtained multiple degrees, demonstrating his unwavering commitment to academic excellence. His career trajectory is a testament to his dedication as he honed his surgical skills in Dublin, embarked on a transformative journey in London for middle grade surgical training, and ventured across the Atlantic to the United States for a two-year fellowship at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania and the New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center. He then returned to Ireland and completed his SPR training here, followed by a clinical fellowship in surgical oncology at the renowned Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, where he explored his interests around the complex domains of breast cancer and melanoma. Now, as a consultant surgeon, his impact extends beyond the operating room and research lab. He is a dedicated educator, having assumed leadership roles at RCSI and taking the helm as the editor of several undergraduate textbooks and receiving multiple teaching awards. His authorship extends to over 400 publications and peer-reviewed journals, a testament to his profound influence and a knowledge sharing within the medical community. Suffice to say, his legacy of achievements, wisdom, and guidance have been instrumental in shaping the future of countless medical minds and continues to inspire and guide the medical world. We are truly privileged to have with us today this esteemed general breast and endocrine surgeon, Professor Arnie Hill, and he is here to take us through a critical topic in today's surgical society, the evaluation of a breast lump. Prof, welcome and thank you so much for accepting our invitation to the ISTG podcast.
Can I say thank you very much, Sinead? I hardly recognise myself in that, but a very kind introduction. Great to be here, and how can I help? Let's start.
Brilliant. Okay, so as mentioned before, today we are talking about breast lumps. So just to kick things off from a fundamental point of view, Prof, I'd like you to tell us, what is the significance of finding a breast lump and why is it a cause for concern to a patient or physician who finds a breast lump on examination?
So the first thing is, if a woman finds a breast lump and a doctor on exam finds a breast lump, if they're over the age of 40, you have to firstly consider, is this a cancer, and work out clinically, has it features suspicious of a cancer, and then do the appropriate imaging and workup. I think the most important thing is, with clinical experience, to try and recognize what is a significant lump, and there are all the clinical features that we look at, skin tethering, whether it's hard, firm, but these come with experience, and after years of examination, one gets more experience. But clinically, anyone who has a lump, firstly, work them up appropriately, appropriate imaging, and the clinical signs to recognize, such as the firmness, the size, whether there's skin tethering, whether there's peau d'orange, whether it's attached to the underlying muscle. These are the important things. And then to look at the regional lymph nodes.
Perfect. And I am glad that you highlighted there the need to be able to distinguish a significant lump on clinical finding. And just to remind our audience, although breast cancer is at the top of our list of differentials, it is important to bear in mind that there are other benign possibilities, such as fibroadenoma, breast cyst, breast abscesses, fat necrosis, and intraductal papilloma. And just to touch very briefly on these, of course, we know fibroadenomas are the most common benign growths in the breast and usually occurs in women of reproductive age. And on examination, they are highly mobile, well-defined and rubbery masses and are historically termed breast mice. Of course, with the breast cyst, these have a more fluctuant feel on examination, and breast abscesses may also be fluctuant and exhibit those classic signs of infection, such as erythema, warmth, and tenderness. But of course, in certain cohorts and populations, especially in women over the age of 40, as Professor Hill just said, our top differential is breast cancer. So, Prof, take us through the clinical assessment process for a woman who presents to clinic with a breast lump. So let's start with clinical history. What are the important questions that you should be asking the patient?
So the most important question is the age. So the age of the patient, the older a patient is, the more likely they are to have cancer. So their age, and then did they identify the lump, how long it's been there, and has it changed? They will be the key aspects. Then in the history, you want to look at the family history. And I guess the easy way to think about family history is two first-degree relatives under the age of 50 is important. If you have two first-degree relatives under the age of 50, that's a mother or sister who were diagnosed under the age of 50, that puts them in a very much more significant risk. But definitely pay respect to the family history. They would be the most important parameters. There are other risk factors that are relevant, but they would be the main ones.
Okay, so apart from family history then, what and age, what are the other risk factors that you might ask about?
If they're on HRT is a risk factor, if they've been on the oral contraceptive pill, age at menarche, age at first child delivery, these are all risk factors that are of significance, but in clinical practice, the most important two are age and family history.
Okay, that's fair enough. And then what about clinical examination?
So the first thing is look on inspection and to see if there's any tethering of the skin, ask them to elevate their hands, and then to see if there's any change in the focal area where she says she feels the lump. Then you palpate it and you look to see the size. Is it tender? Is it fixed to the underlying structures or the overlying structures? They will be the key components, and then to assess the regional lymph nodes, not only the axillary ones, but also the supraclavicular lymph nodes. They will be the important aspects of clinical examination.
Okay, so the patient is in clinic, you've taken their history and done the clinical examination, and you perhaps are suspecting that this is a malignancy. I suppose the next step is potentially radiological investigations, would that be correct?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, so can you maybe talk us through what are the primary modalities of imaging that are used?
So I think in a person who comes into a symptomatic breast clinic, if they're over the age of 35, they must get a mammogram. If they're under 35 and their clinical examination is normal, they need reassurance. But if they have a focal abnormality under the age of 35, they need an ultrasound. And that's really important, a focal abnormality. If they're over the age of 35 and they have a lump, they need not only a mammogram, but a focused ultrasound of that lump. So okay. The combination of mammography and ultrasound are used to evaluate a focal lump.
Okay. And for the mammogram and the ultrasound, can you take us through what exactly we're looking for on each of those imaging?
Yeah. So on the mammogram, firstly, it's worth knowing there are two views, the craniocaudal and the mediolateral oblique, so the CC and the MLO. Two views are done on a mammogram. That would be a traditional mammogram. There now is a tomosynthesis mammogram where they do multiple views of the breast, which is effectively like doing a CT scan of the breast, which picks up smaller tumours and has now become standard in most imaging units where you use tomosynthesis imaging. So the most important aspect is to tell your radiologist what the clinical findings are. And we have a scoring system that we use. It's a scoring system, S1 to S5. S1 and 2 are normal. S3 is probably normal. S4 is probably cancer. And S5 is cancer. So you give the radiologist your clinical opinion based on the S scoring. Now, it's S scoring in most clinical units. Some use the letter E, but between S and E, they're the main letters that are used. It's basically your clinical scoring system, and it's a numerical system to identify your clinical concern.
Okay. And then on the ultrasound, what would be sort of suspicious features?
Yeah, so again, on ultrasound, for example, you may see on ultrasound a very beautiful rounded cyst, which you'll get, it'll just look like a cyst. It'll be well rounded and it'll be smooth features, and that will be diagnosed. The other features, if it's a cancer, you'll have an irregular outline, and the shadow that you will create will be irregular.
Okay, good. And then in a mammogram, is there anything in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. On a mammogram, if you get a white spiculated mass, irregular in outline, that again would be classic of malignancy. Remember, a cancer looks white on a mammogram. So in a 100-year-old lady, her mammogram will be black in outline. So it's easy to pick up a cancer in a lady who's 100 years of age because it's white on black. If you go back and do a mammogram in a 20-year-old girl, the image will be completely white because of all the activity of the breast tissue and the hormonal changes that happen. So it's really hard to find a mammogram of use in detecting a breast cancer at the age of 20, because white on white, you can't see. They talk about trying to find a polar bear in the snow. You can't do it. And that's why we have this cutoff. When you get to over 40, mammography is much more useful at detecting breast cancer, because the density of the mammogram changes and it allows you to see white on black. Taking the extreme, when you're 100 years of age, your mammogram, your x-ray of your breast will be black. And if there's a cancer there, white on black and easy to see. And the opposite extreme, at 20, it's white on white.
Fair enough.
So we use mammography, particularly over the age of 40. Our current screening is 50 to 69 in Ireland. That is probably likely to change and go down to 47 in the years ahead. It's the 47 in the UK at the moment.
Okay.
Every 2 years in Ireland, it's every 3 years in the UK, just to know about the screening programs and the differences.
Absolutely. Thank you. And with regards to imaging, we're still just on that bit. There is sometimes the need for an MRI of the breast.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
I think all students taking the MRCS need to know the indications for MRI. We use it for people who have invasive lobular carcinoma and for those who have a family history. Invasive lobular carcinoma, because we know that that pathology is associated with 10% of cancers having a cancer in the opposite breast. So if you have a breast cancer in one breast, you will want to look with MRI at the opposite breast. The other reason we do an MRI in invasive lobular carcinoma is because a lobular cancer tends to be more diffuse and more challenging to pick up on a mammogram. A ductal carcinoma is very discrete in outline. You can see it on the mammogram. So the indications for MRI or invasive lobular carcinoma are those who have a particular family history. So in patients who have an elevated family history risk, there is a role for MRI specifically for them.
Okay, brilliant, thanks. So the idea of triple assessment comes up when we're talking about the evaluation of breast cancer. So we've gone through sort of like the clinical assessment and the radiological assessment.
Yeah, so let's talk about clinical assessment. It's the three components: clinical, radiological, and pathological. The clinical is what the examination findings, the radiological is the imaging findings, and the pathology, likewise, is what the pathologist finds when you give them a sample of tissue. What sample of tissue? Well, most symptomatic breast units now use core biopsy to get a histological diagnosis. It is possible also to use cytology, but there's a concern that using cytology alone is associated with a high false negative rate. So you're better off using histology with a core biopsy, and that's more or less standard in most symptomatic units.
Okay, and can you actually elaborate a little bit more on the pathological features that aid in the classification of breast cancer?
So there are one way of classifying it is the histological type, which is invasive ductal or invasive lobular, and then the other rarer types. 80% are ductal, 10% are lobular, and then there are the other types. So just remember that ductal is most common, then lobular, and then others. That's the traditional way of looking at it based on the histological subtype. I suppose the newer way of looking at breast cancer is based on the receptor profile and the biology. And I think that's a good way of looking at it. So we have subsets of breast cancer that are new and are treated differently based on their receptor subtype. So I'm going to bring in two concepts. One is the estrogen receptor status, and two is the HER2 status. They are receptors on a breast cancer cell that will determine the management pathway. The first group we'll talk about is those who are HER2 positive, because they now, as standard of care, will receive neoadjuvant anti-HER2 treatment along with chemotherapy. The second group that it's important to know about are those that are called triple negative. They have no estrogen receptor, no progesterone receptor, and no HER2 receptor on their breast cancer tissue. And they are called triple negative. They also now will get neoadjuvant chemotherapy before surgery.
Okay, so now, as with every cancer diagnosis, following pathological confirmation, the patient requires staging of their disease. Can you walk us through the staging investigations and the process?
Okay, to get on to staging of breast cancer, when you have the patient in front of you, you first of all have your clinical staging. So you examine the patient, and you have your clinical size, and clinically whether the nodes are involved. Then you have your histological staging, so you will actually find out if the nodes are involved histologically. At that stage, this staging for patients with node-positive disease in clinical practice today is to do a staging CT scan of the thorax, abdomen, and pelvis. The role of bone scanning at the moment is probably becoming less critical because the CT scan tends to pick up most of what the bone scan shows. So the role of bone scanning may be becoming less mandatory in the management of breast cancer. The other thing to appreciate is if you have node negative disease, you do not need a staging CT scan. If you have node negative disease, the standard evaluations would be liver function tests and a chest x-ray as your staging modalities for early breast cancer that does not involve the lymph nodes. The other one to bear in mind is if the woman says, I have low back pain, or if they have significant systemic pain, that should be considered an appropriate imaging relevant to that area.
Brilliant. And can you just give us a rundown of the classification system, the TNM staging for breast cancer?
Yes. So the most important thing to remember is the staging of breast cancer. The key is that a T2 tumour is 2 to 5 centimetres. T1, less than 2 centimeters. T3, more than 5 centimeters. So you have your T stage, your N stage, and your M stage. Your N stage, node positive N1, N0. M stage, M1, M0. But your T stage, if it's T2, it's 2 to 5 centimeters. Okay?
Okay.
Less than 2 centimeters for T1.
Brilliant. Okay. So you mentioned their node positive disease. Does everyone go on to have a sentinel lymph node biopsy?
Everybody with an invasive breast cancer should get a sentinel lymph node biopsy. And those with DCIS that is more than 5 centimeters or palpable DCIS should get a sentinel node as well.
Okay.
But remember, all invasive breast cancers get a sentinel node.
Okay. Good.
That's how we stage the axilla.
Okay. All right. So we have our stages. Can you tell us a little bit more about the treatment for each of those stages?
Okay. So the first thing to decide in treatment is the patient going to get surgery first or neoadjuvant systemic therapy. And I've mentioned the two groups to consider for neoadjuvant, the HER2 positives and the triple negatives. They should be considered for neoadjuvant therapy first. If you're proceeding with surgery first, your choice is breast conserving surgery versus mastectomy. And in relation to the axilla, sentinel node first, if it's positive, then you have a decision as to whether there's a benefit to going on to do an axillary dissection, which is new. There's lots of trials in recent years to say that we don't need to clear the axilla in all node positives. We need to be selective in our approach to the axilla.
Okay. And following on from your point on surgical management, as you said, broadly speaking, there is breast conserving resection or wide local excision and mastectomy. Mastectomies are by nature quite deforming, and there is typically reconstruction which follows this. Can you give us a brief overview on the oncoplastic reconstruction options available to patients?
So in relation to reconstruction, women undergoing a mastectomy should be supported if they wish to have an immediate reconstruction. The typical types can be categorized as implant-based reconstruction or using autologous tissue. The autologous tissue can be the latissimus dorsi muscle from the back, or what is now probably the most popular and taking over is the DF reconstruction, the deep inferior epigastric pedicle reconstruction. That is increasingly become more popular. It is more invasive. It requires microsurgical skills. It takes a longer procedure, and it's a significant strain on resources. But it certainly gives you a wonderful reconstruction. It feels and looks more natural. The implant can give a very, very good reconstruction as well. It probably feels like an implant and not like normal breast tissue, but it looks very good. So there are two different types. They will be the common ones in most units.
Okay. So there's also the concept of immediate versus delayed.
Yeah, so it's the patient preference. Women should be supported if they'd like to have it done immediately within the resources available and the support structure available, that immediate reconstruction should be offered to those who wish to have it. Logistically, it's not always possible, but the aim would be to have it that way.
And is there any instances where you won't?
Well, I think if you have somebody with a heavy nodal burden, again, there's no data to say that the outcome is worse, but sometimes people feel the requirement to get onto systemic therapy might be a priority than any potential delay that might occur with immediate reconstruction, although that's not common in practice. But sometimes there is a view that people with locally advanced disease may not be best served by an immediate reconstruction. But there are two schools of thought on that. And it really depends on, I think it should be the patient choice. Often if you present with a locally advanced breast cancer, many women don't have as their major focus having an immediate reconstruction. There may be a reason why they've presented late. But it really shouldn't be the surgeon making that choice. It should be the woman.
Okay.
So I think you make it available to them. And they choose.
Okay, that's fair enough. Okay, and then what are the factors then that influence whether or not they go on to have adjuvant therapy?
So probably the most important in this area is the concept of oncotype testing, which allows us to be selective in who benefits from adjuvant systemic therapy. So oncotype testing is for a cohort of patients who are ER positive and HER2 negative. It's where you take the patient's tumor and look at 21 genes within the tumor, and you get a score between 0 and 100. And essentially, if you have a score less than 25, you don't need chemotherapy. More than 25, you do. It's based on data on thousands of women who have had those similar genetic profiles and looking at their survival and the benefit of systemic chemotherapy. So oncotype testing for ER-positive, HER2-negative patients is standard of care. It has reduced the requirement for adjuvant systemic therapy significantly, probably by up to 50% in patients undergoing breast cancer treatment. So it's very expensive. It's over €3,000 to do the test, but it's very beneficial in avoiding unnecessary chemotherapy.
And we've spoken a lot about chemotherapy. Is there any role for radiotherapy in the treatment of breast cancer?
So very much so. In fact, a very significant proportion of all patients get radiotherapy. So if you've got breast conserving surgery, you will definitely get radiotherapy to the conserved breast. If you have node positive breast cancer, you will get radiotherapy. And if you have a tumor more than 5 centimeters in size, you will get chest wall radiation therapy. So there are three indications there that are pretty standard. And we find in our practice that probably over 80% of patients get radiation treatment because you've either had breast conserving surgery or you've got node positive disease or you have a tumor more than 5 centimeters. And they tend to be the main criteria that help radiation oncologists know and when to give radiation therapy.
Okay, good. Are there any novel therapies for breast cancer that you can tell us about?
Yeah, I think there's lots of technical things that are improved. So in the radiation field, they're giving the appropriate dosage in 1 week as opposed to 3 weeks. That's a significant advance for patients. There's a really small cohort that get intraoperative radiotherapy, very small, highly selected. In the surgical field, We've lots of advances, as you know, in sentinel node. There's the Dieppe reconstructions. But I think probably the most important advances are in our systemic therapies, where I think in the HER2 field, there have been an exciting range of drugs that have made a significant difference over the last 10 years to increase our complete response rate to 65%. So that's one of the big areas of interest in breast cancer is when do we get to the stage when we know the drugs are going to give 100, well, as close to 100% complete response rate. That means we're out of business as surgeons, but I think that's a while away.
Okay. Yeah, so that actually leads me to the last question that I have for you. Where do you see treatment for breast cancer progressing over the next 10 years?
So I think we're going to have a number of changes. We're going to have a lot more complete responses to systemic therapy where surgery won't be necessary. You'll be following patients, and those that do recur may get further treatment or may get surgery, but there'll be less role for surgery in, I think, the HER2 cohort in probably the next 5 years. But there will be a change in that we know there'll probably be more risk reduction surgery. Our understanding of mutation carriers, there's BRCA1, BRCA2, but a whole panel of other drugs, such the CHEK2, the PALB2s, these mutations that are rare, but we'll probably do more genetic testing and people will understand our risk better. So you'll have a whole cohort of patients having risk reduction surgery and reconstructive surgery. So I think it'll still remain busy for the surgeons.
Well, Prof, it has been an absolute pleasure sharing the microphone with you today as you walked us through that whistle-stop tour of evaluation of a breast lump.
Thanks.
And my dear listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to the ISTG podcast, Suit Yourself. I have been your host, Sinead Ramjet. I'll catch you next time. And until then, stay curious, stay informed, and of course, stay sharp.
If you found this podcast informative and engaging, we would greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to subscribe and share your thoughts by leaving a review on the platform you're listening to.
Our podcast is dedicated to improving valuable insights to surgical trainees, enabling you to stay well informed about prevalent surgical presentations.
Should you have any inquiries or wish to connect, please don't hesitate to contact us at podcast@istg.ie. Many thanks for listening.
Until we meet again, stay curious, stay informed, and of course, stay sharp.